Let's get started. We have a guest speaker this morning, Dr. Brian Richards, who's in the Department of Ag Engineering. I've known Brian for many years. In fact, he took this course. When did you take it, Brian?
49 semesters ago.
49 semesters ago. And he has done a lot of work in the area of sewage sludge and agricultural bans. Brian is a senior research associate. Some of you may not know what that means at Cornell. Senior research associates have most of the academic credentials, PhDs and so on, as regular faculty, but their assignment is mainly in the area of research rather than classroom teaching, although some of them do some classroom teaching as well. Brian has been right at the forefront of some of the concern about use of sewage sludge on agricultural lands. I invited him partly because he provides a nice balance in some ways to some of the arguments that Bogowski and others made, although I think ultimately these are not contradictory. They just show different aspects of the problem, because in some ways Dr. Richards will argue that we are not being cautious enough when it comes to applying agriculture or sewage sludge to agricultural lands. And that, I think, will help us in the discussion of these issues, particularly as we looked at Wildowski's precautionary principle, and this week as we're looking at the reading from Bjorn Lomborg in the Skeptical Environmentalist. So, without further introduction, I'll let Brian take over. He said that he'll leave 5 or 10 minutes at the end for us to ask questions or make comments about what he's doing.
Thank you, Dick. Can everyone hear me okay? I got a sore throat talking yesterday, so I'll work harder at it today. And as Dick mentioned, yes, it was didn't seem that long ago when I was my senior year sitting here in NatRes 407, but I made the mistake last night of adding up how many semesters it was, and it was 49. That was kind of set me back a little. I'm talking today about the land application of wastewater sludge, and I called it science, policy, and politics. And what I mean by politics is not the electoral college and the two-party system, but just all those other factors that that affect what people choose to do. And I have here at the bottom a disclaimer, and you'll see why I have this later on. Any opinions expressed are not those of, the university, the college, the department, our group, or they may not even be my own, but I just wanted to make a broad-based disclaimer here. And I've been, my own research has been on a fairly narrow slice of what we're talking about, but I've been an observer and part of a Cornell group that's been involved in this larger question. So I hope you'll find the discussion interesting today. First question that comes up is, what is sludge? And the short answer, it is the contaminants that are removed from wastewater. Those of you who have taken any environmental engineering or pollution control courses, you might recognize this treatment schematic. When wastewater enters a treatment plant, there's usually primary and secondary and increasingly tertiary treatment. The primary settles out what will settle out of its own accord from the wastewater. In secondary treatment, you use various methods of encouraging microbial growth, and those microbes digest the organics present and take up nutrients. And then the microbes themselves are settled out of the wastewater. And finally, tertiary is done more and more to remove, in fact, they call it polishing, to try to remove extra nitrogen and phosphorus, typically. And everything that comes out of the bottom of that is sludge. And this is a good thing, because we do not want those things in water. Sludge is typically treated in various ways to reduce its mass, reduce its volume, to make it less active when it's disposed, and to make it more attractive or more palatable as a reuse product. What sludge contains? Well, we've already alluded to the fact that there's nutrients, and there's the organic matter. Largely, it's the bodies of these bacteria you've been growing. And these are the good things. These are the things that people want to recycle and reuse. But sludge also contains a wide range of contaminants, trace elements, the heavy metals, you know, the bad stuff, mercury and lead, and cadmium and arsenic, and a wide range of other elements are present. There's also a very wide range of synthetic organics. Again, anything that goes into the sewer ends up, if it doesn't go out in the wastewater, and if it's not degraded in the sewage treatment process, it ends up in the sludge. So we're talking about surfactants, all that soap and detergent and laundry detergent we use, a wide range of industrial and domestic chemicals. Pharmaceuticals, this has been an interesting area of inquiry in the last 10 years, especially people finding pharmaceuticals, prescription drugs ending up in the wastewater and in the surface waters that are discharged out of treatment plants. And also present are metabolites, just as a general class. These are the daughter products that are sometimes formed during the sewage treatment process. And those of you who have studied some of these, you may know that often the toxicity of metabolites is greater than the products from which they were derived. So in some cases, you'll find substantial concentrations of metabolites. The other class and the other basis for concern with wastewater sludge is the presence of pathogens. We're talking bacteria, viruses, and then a wide range of parasites. And these are all present in sludge. Sludge is treated to reduce pathogens. There's a couple different classes. Class B sludge, there needs to be some reduction. Typically, anaerobic digestion accomplishes that reduction. And then there's other, in fact, they're called processes to further reduce pathogens, to reduce the pathogen numbers even more. Ever since especially since 1992, there has been a move to land apply sludge. And the current numbers nationally are that 60% of sludge produced in the country is land applied, and that's, 5.5 million tons. I think that's dry tons per year. It doesn't even count the water. And here you see, this is from a farm in New York State. It's what they call the Terragator. It's a sludge injection machine that injects the sludge and then it mixes it into the soil right away. Some of the factors that have led to the land application, first of all, was the prohibition of ocean dumping in 1992. And some people suggest that this was actually more a political decision than one that was based on a lot of scientific review. But Congress made that decision, and but there were other factors as well. One is recycling. And again, there's lots of good nutrients and organic matter, which both of which are good for soil, good for agriculture. And you will soon, if you start reading about the sludge field, you soon come across the term beneficial use or beneficial reuse. Rather than simply disposing of the sludge, let's do something good with it. One place where it seems to be effective is in land reclamation. If you have strip mine lands, they'll lay down a fairly heavy blanket of sludge just to get some organic matter and nutrients into a landscape that looks like a moonscape otherwise. A recurring concern is landfill availability and cost, because this is one of the main disposal routes for sludge, and it seems that we go through cycles of, you know, we're about to run out of landfill space and there's a big panic, and then I think we're at the other end of that cycle at the moment where there seems to be adequate space and the costs are not too high. Another factor in the land application has been work by EPA, what's called source reduction. They've actually gone after industries threatening to fill their manhole with concrete if they don't reduce the contaminant load that is being sent to sewage treatment plants. So there's industrial pretreatment that is required. And this has substantially reduced the concentration of some of the nastier contaminants in sludge. Others have pointed out that some of the worst industries have simply moved south of the border and taken their pollution with them. But in any case, there has been a substantial reduction, and I think that's about played out now. There was kind of a steep reduction, and it's leveled off. They've gotten what they could get through that route. And finally, it's been a matter of EPA policy, and we'll talk about that, to promote land application. In 1993, EPA issued what's known as the Part 503 rule, that governs land application. These are national standards that specify the maximum levels of contaminants that can be in sludge that is land applied. States are allowed to be more stringent than these standards, but not allowed to be less stringent. And it was based on a risk assessment. In fact, it's what we call a deterministic risk assessment. In other words, they sat down and tried to come up with the worst case scenario for each of 14 different potential pathways that contaminants would move from the sludge to people or other targets. So they said, okay, here's a farm worker breathing dust, and let's back calculate from that what will be the maximum allowable concentration of pathogens and the trace metals in the sludge. They also did pathways, the home gardener, the growing their food on a garden that has been applied with sludge. Children eating soil, which does occur. Leaching through groundwater, surface runoff. So again, there was 14 different pathways involving livestock and other things. And in the end, the regulations ended up regulating just pathogens and 9 trace elements. And I've listed them here. The potential human toxins, arsenic, cadmium, mercury, lead, and chromium. Molybdenum, which is of concern to grazing animals, and then copper, zinc, and nickel, which their primary concern is with plant toxicity if you apply to cropland. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, some more issues or more features of the 503, and this is something that has become more and more evident. The term self-implementing was used, and it's Professor David Bolden in soils has wondered if we had self-implementing speed control on our highways. You would simply, when you went to renew your license, you'd check a little box on the application saying, "I did not speed." That way you wouldn't need state troopers and radar and speed traps. The sludge situation has been a little bit that way because there's been little real oversight. Now, states, as I said, can have their own more restrictive limits and enforce their standards with their environmental agencies, which is done pretty effectively here in New York State with the Department of Environmental Conservation. But in other states, there is little real oversight, little real regulation, and little recourse to the national level when that doesn't happen. Interestingly, EPA, there was a lot of internal dissent when the Part 503 was promulgated, to use the technical term. There was the derisive term of sludge magic that was applied by many EPA scientists. In fact, there was kind of an interdivision rivalry, so I'm told, and so I read. The Office for Water proposed and is the promoters of land application. The Office for Research and Development, which has the responsibility to check and sign off on the science undergirding different rules, was not at all pleased. They were the ones that came up with the term sludge magic, that somehow the contaminants in sludge were just going to be magically immobilized by soil forever. And the 503s were finally released when the Office for Research and Development insisted that there be a preamble written saying there's a lot more work that needs to be done and a lot more research money that needs to be gone into to confirm whether these numbers are valid, and that's the part that hasn't happened. And I mentioned that there's been active promotion of land application. And a couple examples of that here are the funding that went to WEF, the Water Environment Federation, used to be known as the Water Pollution Control Federation. It's kind of the trade association of water treatment, sewage treatment professionals. And there was funding that went to promote land application both to WEF and to WERF, which is sticking the word research there, their research arm. When the USDA proposed the organic rule, you may be familiar with this. This happened in the last few years. What would a uniform definition for food products that could be termed organic. Their initial proposal was that sludge-applied crops would qualify as being organic. And that raised a lot of ire in the organic community. And that was finally removed from the proposal. But there was some active promotion there of land application. And you won't get too far in the sludge land application field before you run into the word biosolids. And this is the happy face term for sludge. In fact, I've got a complex mathematical model here. In the sewage treatment plant, at least last time I heard, it was still sludge and people working with it. And in fact, the sewage treatment literature, you know, talks about sludge. Then there's typically some additional treatment, although it's not there in any case. But then definitely public relations, because the term biosolids, it was, you know, invented to make sludge more acceptable to the public. I can refer you to a book called Toxic Sludge is Good for You. In fact, here's a flyer. Biosolids, too valuable to waste. Here's the truck going and the flowers growing. This is, you know, promotional literature that was put out by someone. But in this book, it's about PR. And they were, according to the authors, they were, you know, deciding this was a pretty cool title. It came from some cartoon somewhere. But the people involved in changing the name from sludge to biosolids thought that was a bad title. The sludge would be a bad connotation. So in their correspondence with the authors soon became immensely interested in this name change and ended up devoting a chapter of their book to the change from sludge to biosolids. People get really worked up when we talk about sludge and like when you submit an article if it said sludge and not biosolids. So we've conceded to meet them halfway and call it sewage biosolids, which kind of undoes some of the PR effect. Okay, when the 503 came out, and ever since then, there were concerns. And here in the Northeast U.S., some of the concerns were the fact that this was a one-size-fits-all regulation. That it was that factors such as soil and crop type aren't factored in. This is just one set of numbers for the country. And again, here in the Northeast, we tend to have thinner, wetter, more acid soils. That's when snow isn't covering them. The groundwater systems tend to be more shallow. Here in New York, we tend to have dairy-based farm systems. Which is different from something that's simply a, say, a row crop. And as a sidelight, most of these systems are already overloaded with both nitrogen and phosphorus. So the question of bringing in more is interesting. And finally, population proximity. Again, land application can be done legally in very tight quarters. You know, the setback and requirements are not all that strenuous. So those are some of the concerns. And they actually led to some of the Cornell research, and this is when I kind of joined on. After graduating here, I'd worked on a variety of mostly bioenergy projects with Professor Bill Jewell. But then in 1993, as that funding was winding down, this project was gearing up. Funded, interestingly enough, by NYSERDA, the Energy Research and Development Authority here in New York State. And again, to address some of these concerns, what's the long-term fate of sludge? Does how the sludge is treated affect the mobility of contaminants? And what about soil type and pH? And so Tom O. Steinhaus, professor in my department, and John Peverly in soils had written a major proposal and was funded, and off we went. And that's actually been funded by other funding sources, including USDA and the U.S. Geological Survey. Now, just list here some of our general findings. In fact, before I do that, we'll go out to a picture. Here's just part of our greenhouse study. We have 90 soil columns where we actually looked at sludge treated five different ways on two different soil types, each at two different pHs, in triplicate plus a few extra controls, and it brings you up to 90. And this is our most recent cycle with soybeans. We've actually examined four other crops, and this has been a 9.5-10 year study that's going on. Some of the general findings that we have published are one, that some prior research was invalidated. That's one of the first things that we found out. A lot of research conventionally in movement of contaminants through soils, you go get a soil column by digging up some soil, bring it in, sieve it, screen it, pack it into a column. And that destroys all the structure and all the natural flow paths in soil. And if you apply a contaminant, the odds are pretty good that contaminant will be absorbed because the water's moving uniformly and interacting with the soil. If, however, you bring in what's called an undisturbed soil column, so you go out and dig and expose a column of soil and plunk a piece of culvert over it, spray in some foam, and the next day you've got a piece of the field that you can carry into the lab and then do your transport studies, the existence of those natural, what are called preferential flow paths, will vastly accelerate pollutant transport. In fact, our group has a website just devoted to preferential flow. It involves transport of pathogens from manure and pesticides and anything that's reaching groundwater a lot faster than they thought it would. That usually involves preferential flow. Well, a lot of the prior research didn't use undisturbed soil columns, and so anyone who did a sewage sludge study and found that nothing leached, if they used packed columns, that finding can be disregarded because of that experimental setup. We found that to varying extents, sludge contaminants can and do leach. How the sludge was treated, the soil type and the soil pH all have significant effects. One of our interesting findings was one sludge that was treated to really reduce mobility actually ended up accelerating mobility. And conversely, one that was supposed to be a worst case turned out to be a best case. So the conventional wisdom in 93 was not holding true. We've been seeing that metal uptake by the crops and some of the other long-term crop impacts seem to be more likely than thought. Again, the sludge magic is things were going to stay immobile forever, whereas this, in fact, we're beginning to wonder if we're seeing a rebound effect. Now, in contrast, we've also done some farm monitoring at a large farm in western New York where they know what they're doing in terms of their good managers. They're applying sludge at very low rates in terms of how many tons per acre per year. It's a very large operation. And we didn't find any substantial impacts. You could see blips in the water quality or surface runoff, but it was nothing